Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, Lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he can fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Because it's cold, the beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
Speaking of TV, you know, I know this is going to annoy you when I say this, but my favorite show on television is Snowfall. I know this is going to annoy you when I say this. I know this.
Boo!
Have you watched it at all?
Never. Well, I'm not really into fairy tales.
Okay.
First of all.
Because the story, as someone who's watched it, who's watched every episode, it is clearly the Ricky Ross story. Based on the... I'm not saying exactly...
You're right. And you're right. You're probably right. But it's
all the way to the... There's a whole Nicaraguan Contra with a DEA agent. You know, like... The whole... Based on all the conversations you and I have had together, this is so...
They probably watched
your
interviews, too.
They probably did. John Singleton probably... Because John Singleton actually met with you before the show came out.
He read my script. He read the movie script. He read the book. He bought one of my demo books.
Okay.
He bought, I had got 10 books when my book came. Before the book actually was delivered to me in bulk, they gave me 10 demos. Well, one guy paid me $100 for a demo book. John Singleton, I think, he gave me $50 for a demo book.
Okay.
Because I wasn't going to sell the demos. And they made me sell them. But yeah, he, and I ran into John too recently. It was strange.
Okay. Because you guys met up and you guys were talking about doing a project together.
Yeah. I wanted John to direct my movie.
Okay.
Well, really, the whole team wanted John to direct the movie.
And John Singleton's phenomenal. Regardless of the differences, you know what I mean? Because Snowfall almost looks like a higher budget Boys in the Hood. You know, it has that same type of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys met up.
But he still missed the mark, though, I can tell you. Just from me talking to people, he doesn't. And I don't really expect him to, you know, to really get it because he didn't live it.
Right.
You know, so I was talking to some people the other day, and they was like, well, what's going to be different than this and Snowfall? And I was like, well, I never saw Snowfall, but I can tell you this here. Snowfall don't know when Big Hugh got out of prison. You know, Snowfall don't know a lot of the other things. I ain't going to say too much.
Yeah.
they'll be trying to pick stuff up. They called me about 3 months ago. It was like, man, we want you to come on as a consultant. We're running out of material.
He said no.
Of course not. Not now. You know, I don't want to save you.
Yeah.
You know, if you die, you die on your own. I ain't going to help save you, though. I ain't gonna breathe life into you.
It's too bad. It's too bad that you were involved in it. Because like I said, it is very, very similar to your story. Down to the...
Well, I also ran into the actor, too.
Oh, the main guy?
Yeah, the main guy.
The British guy.
I was at Whole Foods one day, and he recognized me, and he came up, and he said how much he wished that I was actually on the set with him.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I would have been there, they would have had to change the name from Franklin to Freeway.
You're right. Two F names. Oh, yeah, wow. They really...
Yeah, but,
yeah, man, but you know...
No, I ain't mad, though. I'm not mad at the show. You know, I just don't support it. And I don't really have time. You know, I don't really watch TV anyway.
Right.
I'm too busy, you know, trying to write movie scripts and TV shows and, you know, just do my own thing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's too bad because they did do a good job on that show. And having you involved would have, I think, made it that much better.
Oh, no, no. If they would have had me on there, if people in America would have known that that was my story, they would be getting the same kind of results that Netflix is getting with the documentary.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny because me being on the street, I get to know what is getting traction. You know, like I know how well your shows are. Like I never looked at your numbers on the internet.
Yeah.
Not one time have I went on the internet and looked at your numbers.
Right, but you see the people that approach you.
Right, when I walk through an airport and people come up and they talk about you and they ask me what you like, then that tells me that we got traction.
Yeah.
So the same thing when the documentary hit Netflix, you know, I could tell what a difference it made.
Yeah. Well, I guess the TV series is supposed to be with the executive producers of Power.
Which one, mine?
Yeah.
That deal expired.
Oh, didn't work out.
Nah, not yet. They still on deck. You know, they want Kendrick Lamar to say if I could tie a deal up with Kendrick Lamar, then they would write the check tomorrow.
Kendrick had an appearance on Power. He had a cameo.
Mm,
one
okay.
episode.
But you know, I got other people that we're talking to about. About doing the series. I really think that Netflix, it would be something that Netflix should have picked up immediately, but I don't know, these people in Hollywood, they just don't,
I hate dealing with people in Hollywood.
Yeah, they just don't get it.
I absolutely hate it. In fact, the reason why I launched Vlad TV is because I just got sick of having these conversations with TV and movie people.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? This is why Vlad TV is self-sufficient. And even to this day, not a year passes where there isn't some sort of serious discussion over a TV
deal or whatever else, and they've never gone anywhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just not.
Yeah, they don't get it.
It's a hurry up and wait type of game. And
they go with the norms. You know,
yeah,
who's
exactly.
been here, who's been doing it, that's what we
exactly.
want to go with. And they don't really understand the people that they're selling these shows to. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's why their ratings be so low, you know. And I totally get it.
All right, today's podcast, and we're going to go to the phone line here quick. Matter of fact, you want to get on air, any topic, comment, whatever, news, just press 1. What's the number here? 619-768-2945. And I like to say press 1 if you want to get in any topics, expression. We're sort of like doing trending topics. But to kick things off, if people want to bite at this topic, today's title we have Chess Strategies, the Art and Science of Financial Offense and Defense. And often, well, maybe not often enough, but every now and then I talk about the game of chess, because the game of chess, you can apply it to so many situations in life. And in the game of chess, you've got to, some of the fundamentals is, number one, the landscape. Now, we can parallel this to everyday life of anybody listening to this live stream. The landscape in the game of chess is the chessboard. It's got 64 squares. And in life, there's a landscape. There's geography. All right? And I'll lay one out here. Black Wall Street. Okay, Black Wall Street. And let's call this example Black Wall Street chess. All right? What's the first thing that a person who's learning how to play chess or knows how to play chess, what's the first thing that you must be, before you even know who the players are, the first thing you must know is the landscape. What's the geography? All right, now, with Black Wall Street, you know, we're playing Black Wall Street chess, the geography, or one of the geographic locations was the state of Oklahoma. All right, that's the chessboard. All right, now, Black Wall Street, also known as the Greenwood neighborhood, which O.W. Gurley, he bought 40 acres of land within the municipality of the city of Oklahoma, which was known at that time as hostile territory for black folk. They had a strong, allegedly they had a strong Ku Klux Klan support presence in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, once again, we're looking at the land, the chessboard. In this case, it's the state of Oklahoma. Now, so O.W. Gurley, that's where he lined up his players. All right, now, what a lot of people don't know about is that also on that chessboard, now we're looking at the whole state of Oklahoma as a chessboard, there were other black communities. Matter of fact, for you guys that are online right now, I want you to type in any search engine, map of Oklahoma black townships. Okay. Map of Oklahoma townships. And there's a few maps you can pick from. All right. Now, some of these black towns still exist, some don't. But at the time that in 1921, when Black Wall Street happened, let me get a better map. So, okay. Well, let's go with the black townships that still exist. Now, not historically, no black township in the state of Oakland experienced any racial violence. That's number one. What about Black Wall Street? Black Wall Street was a neighborhood within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, but it was not its own independent town. That's a major distinction when we're playing Black Wall Street chess. Now, what's on the radar today as far as black townships, and I bet you most of the people that are listening to this podcast have never heard of these towns. You have Tatums, Oklahoma, Lima, Oklahoma, or Lima, Oklahoma, Brooksville, Oklahoma, Boley, Oklahoma, Clearview, Oklahoma, Grayson, Oklahoma, Taft, Oklahoma, Summit, Oklahoma, Renniesville, Oklahoma, Redbird, Oklahoma, Lexington, Oklahoma, Redbird, Oklahoma, and Tallahassee, Oklahoma. I've been to Taft, Summit, and Tallahassee. I've been to those three. Now, that's here today. Now, if we go back in time, I want to get a list so I can read these off. Let me see. If I can get a better map. Okay, this is a better map. All right. Here's some of the other black townships in Oklahoma. And some of these towns were set up for temporary, and some of them just, during the Great Migration, people left these towns and went to larger cities. Ferguson, Oklahoma. Emmanuel, Oklahoma. Eudora, Oklahoma. Cimarron, Oklahoma. Lincoln, Oklahoma. Columbia, Oklahoma. Liberty, Oklahoma. Langston, Oklahoma. Langston, Oklahoma is still here. But there were at least 50 black municipalities. And this map reflects the present as well as black municipalities that existed in the state of Oklahoma. Now, once again, we're playing black towns chess or Black Wall Street chess. Now, in the game of chess, you got to learn how to play offense, and you have to learn how to play defense. In the game of chess, there are different strategies for offense as well as defense. So, one of the distinctions of chess is, as well as in the game of life, you have to, and this is another reason why I like chess. Chess, you're thinking 2, 3, maybe 4, 5, up to 6 steps in advance. You're anticipating possible moves that your opponent can make to catch one of your pieces and then ultimately put your king in check. You've got to think about, now you're not going to think about everything, but, you're thinking, like, say, 3 to 4 steps in advance. Because if you just think one move in advance, you might lose some strategic ground. So you've got to think multiple moves in advance. Now, with the black townships, I'm looking at now with the three black townships that I've actually in Oklahoma that I've actually visited is I'm looking at the town founders say, you know what, let's pick a spot geographically that more than likely anybody that doesn't like us is not going to travel to these places. Because in 2022, unless you actually know where you're going, you're not going to run across these towns. So they were thinking defensively as well as offensively 100 years ago of how they set these towns up. And that's my belief is that that's one of the reasons why these towns, the ones that are remaining, are still around. Where people can trace their bloodline over 100 years. In any event, let's get more into this with the game of chess.
Hey everyone, this is Kevin from thechesswebsite.com, and today I'm going to be covering my favorite topic in chess, and that is chess gambits. Ever since I was a kid, I loved playing chess gambits. Could be because Gambit was my favorite character on X-Men cartoons, or it could be because I loved giving up material in chess and then almost turning it into a puzzle. How can I give up material and then find an advantage for my setup? I just love that. So I made a video on my top 8 favorite chess gambits. Now, it is subjective, so I want to give you the criteria that went into it. The first one is how often you're going to get to play this gambit. There's some obscure gambits that people like out there, but they just never come up. I like gambits that I can play anytime I want to because the positions are always coming up in my chess games. And the next one is how much fun the gambit is. I like to look at my opponent's face and just have them confused, trying to figure out why in the world I would play the moves that I'm making. So hopefully you guys enjoy this video. If you have other gambits that you really, really like, feel free to put those in the comment section below. But I think you'll find some on this video that you may not be familiar with. Also, for the first time in 10 years, we're going to try this out. If you wouldn't mind subscribing to the channel if you're not already and hitting the like button. Again, first time in 10 years, hundreds of videos, never asked for people to do that. But just curious to see how many people we can actually like this video and subscribe to the channel. So without further ado, hopefully you guys enjoy my top 8 chess gambits. Coming in at number 8, we have the Schliemann Gambit, which starts out with the Ray Lopez with e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, bishop to b5. And usually in the Ray Lopez, black's looking to play a6, looking to play knight to f6. But in the Schliemann Gambit, black plays f5, says, I'm going to completely disrupt everything white is looking to do. White can't continue in the same game plan. How do they really continue from here? It looks logical to take this material. That's completely fine. It's what black wants. Black can now push forward with e4. This knight can't come to g5 or h4. It's just going to fall to the queen. If it comes back to g1, that feels really weird. All of a sudden you have d1. The bishop can take here on f5. So all in all, white doesn't have nearly the setup that they were hoping for in the Ray Lopez. All of a sudden, black is really looking to dominate the center of the board. So if you haven't played the Schliemann Gambit, it is a fun way to counter the Ray Lopez. Coming in at number 7, we have the Tennyson Gambit, which starts out with e4, d5. And I feel like anytime black plays this, they almost for sure know that white's going to take here on d5. But what if they don't? What if they play the Tennyson Gambit, which is knight to f3, and says, hey, I don't mind if you take this. I'm going to bring my knight up here to g5, attacking this. Now, they could just say, I'm going to completely ignore that. I don't know what you're up to. Great. You can just come back here and take with your knight. If they try to hold on to this, well, then you can start to get pretty aggressive with bishop to c4. You can see the knight on g5 is already attacking this square here on f7, which is extremely weak. It's only defended by the king here that's on e8 right now. So a lot of strong attacks. They can defend it in many different ways, but white has a strong attack depending on where they move. So that is The tennis and gambit always catches your opponent off guard. Coming at number 6, we have the Halloween Gambit, one of my favorites as a kid because it was the first gambit I played where I wasn't just giving up a pawn. I was actually giving up a knight, a minor piece. So that always intrigued me. Starts out with e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, and then usually gets into the four knights game with knight to c3, knight f6, and then the knight takes here on e5. So exchanging a knight for a pawn after the knight takes, then white starts the offensive attack in the center of the board, pawn to d4. Usually the knight's going to come back to c6, and it can just continue to attack. Knight down here to e5, pawn pushes forward, really just needs to come back here to g6. White can push forward again, knight moves back here. So you can see black is up material, but white has a strong presence in the center of the board. If you haven't ever played the Halloween Gambit, I highly recommend it. Always fun to give up a minor piece early on and then see if you can turn that into a win. Coming in at number 5, we have the Colorado Gambit, which starts out with e4, knight to c6, and then knight to f3. Or it could also start with the knight coming here to f3 first, and then the pawn here to e4. But either way, it's black's move, and the common response is, not what we're going to play. That would be something like e5, bishop down here to b5. This gets into the Ray Lopez, which you could always play the Schliemann Gambit in this if you wanted to. But the Colorado Gambit says we're not even playing e5. We're just going to immediately attack here with f5. So very similar to the Schliemann Gambit, looking to attack the center of the board with the f pawn. Knowing that later on you could castle on the king side, you could have your rook here on the semi-open f-file at some point. Black has a lot of strong attacks, but they never expect you to play this f5. Now if they push forward, that's going to be completely fine. You can start to disrupt the center of the board. This opens up lines for your light square bishop to get involved into the game to take away their center pawn here. If they don't take, maybe they get their bishop involved into the game. Then you can just take their pawn. If they decide to go ahead and take, well, you can just start to push in the center of the board. They've lost their center pawn, so you have a lot of attacking lines in the Colorado Gambit. Definitely a good way to disrupt your opponent when they start out with e4. Knight f3. Coming at number 4, we have the Jerome Gambit, one of the more aggressive lines that you'll see in this video series, but it starts out with e4, e5, knight f3, knight to c6. You can tell what type of games I play a lot of, but instead of the bishop coming to b5, the bishop's going to come to c4. And most common response is bishop down here to c5, and here's where things start to get tricky. The bishop takes on f7, sacrifices material, and said, I'm going to give up my bishop for the pawn so that I can start to attack my opponent's king. Now, they don't have to take the bishop, but if they don't, that's just weird. Like, you should tell them to go ahead and take it because they're going to lose if they don't take it. But once they take it, that allows you to continue with the Jerome Gambit. And that says, I haven't given up enough material. I'm going to give up more. I'm going to go ahead and play knight to e5. This is check. They pretty much have to take with their knight. There's real no real reason for them not to. But after they take with their knight, then queen to h5. And this is where the fun begins. So you can tell you've given up a lot of material already, a knight and a bishop, but you have a strong attack. Their king's out in the center, and you can start to have some fun. So if you haven't played the Jerome Gambit, I highly recommend it. Coming at number 3, we have the Steinitz Gambit, which starts out with e4, e5, but changing things up a little bit, and that is knight to c3. Most players just assume white's going to, if they're going to play a knight, come here to f3, but you don't always have to. You can play knight to c3, and many times black will just respond with the same thing. They'll go ahead and play knight to c6. Say, I'll just marry him, not exactly sure what you're doing, and then you can play f4, and this is where the fun begins in the Steinitz Gambit. After they take here, white's really just looking to dominate the center of the board. That's the main theme of this opening. But after d4, Black can start to attack and play queen down here to h4, and the king has to come to e2. You're not going to play pawn here because then after the pawn takes, you're just giving up more material, and the pawn can't recapture because the rook is going to fall. The king has to come here to e2, and this looks really awkward because the king is blocking this light square bishop, and it can no longer castle to either side of the board, but it actually works out extremely well for white. The knight's going to come here to f3 pretty soon, chase the queen around, while black's busy moving his queen, not doing anything productive. White's over here developing the center of the board, getting all his minor pieces developed into the game, chasing black around. It's a very, very good gambit, and white has a lot of attacking lines that may not look like it when you just look at this board setup right here. Coming in at number two, we have the Cochrane Gambit, and that starts out with e4, e5. Don't judge me. I play a lot of e4 games, and there's a lot of gambits that come out of this. Knight to f3, and then knight to f6. So sometimes black will try the Petrov defense, which is this right here, thinking that they can catch white off guard, and it normally continues with knight to e5, and then the pawn comes to d6, and the knight comes back to f3, and then the knight takes here, and then we continue on the board. But what if white says, not today. I'm not going to retreat. I'm going to continue my attack, and that's exactly what the Cochrane Gambit does, and the knight takes here on f7. Now, after the king takes, if they don't take, that's just weird. You're going to take this rook. You're going to take the queen. Bad things are going to happen. So after they take here, then white's going to play d4. Because this opens up all the lines. The queen is online. The light square bishop's online. Now the dark square bishop's online. It's also giving up another pawn of material. If they want to take that, that's fine. Queen can come over here to h5. This square is no longer protected, attacking the king. The queen can swing over here depending on where the king goes to. Can get both the bishops involved. Things are extremely bad for black. Definitely a fun way. Anytime someone tries the Petrov, this is always my go-to because it catches them off guard. They just always expect the knight to come back here to f3. But then just to see them after I played knight to f7 and realize that they're going to get their king chased around the board for the rest of the game. Coming in at number one, we have the Muzio Gambit. And yes, it derives from the King's Gambit, but I felt like it was almost cheating to have number one being the King's Gambit because I always do videos on the King's Gambit. Most of you know that that is my favorite opening, but this is a specific variation in the King's Gambit that is my favorite. Anytime I get the opportunity to play it, I absolutely will. The King's Gambit, for those not familiar, e4, e5, f4, and then after the pawn recaptures, knight to f3. Now, the Muzio Gambit really needs them to come down with the g5, which many times they will. They're start to attack on the king side of the board. This protects this pawn and start to add pressure on this g4 square. Sometimes in the King's Gambit, you'll play h4, so that then when they come down here to g4, you have an outpost. You can start to attack, get your light square bishop over here to c4 and attack the f7 square. But that's not what the Muzio Gambit's looking to do. Says, I don't even care about that. I'm just going to start developing my material. And so if they push forward, this is where it gets even more fun because you're just going to castle on a king set. You don't even care about the knight. After they take with their pawn, you're going to recapture with your queen. So you can see you have your most powerful piece involved into the game. You have your bishop here eyeing down on the weakest square. You've already castled. You have a rook open on the semi-open file. They can't castle on the king side and have king safety. Their g-pawn is gone. They have no pieces developed. You can easily push forward here with a d4 and get your dark square bishop involved into the game. So anytime I play the King's Gambit, although I don't know what my opponent's going to do, the Muzio Gambit is my number one go-to if I have the opportunity to play it. So that is my list of top 8 chess gambits. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this video. Again, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the video. And if you liked this list and want to see more, feel free to give me a thumbs up. Also, if you have a gambit that I did not cover, that you want to let people know about that you enjoy playing, feel free to leave that in the comments. If you have other chess video ideas, you can always contact me at email, thechesswebsite@gmail.com. That is the best way to reach out to me. But thank you guys so much for watching, and I will see you.
Well, okay, if you ain't got the guts to play me, Clifton, is anybody else? Anyone?
Yo, I'll play this.
You like cards? Fine. We'll play cards. Here's the deal. If you win, the whole class gets to do whatever they want for the rest of detention.
Oh, what?
Hey, y'all.
But
if I win, you learn a new game.
You hustling me?
Hustle? You don't want to play cards, homie.
You right.
Go ahead and play this clown, Peanut. You never get beat.
You know the game? Find the red ace? Huh? My name is Peter Paul. I come from Montreal. Came to play them all. I've broken hipsters and slicksters, elbows and a-holes.
My name is Peter, what?
Go ahead and pick the one you like. Nah, read your dead, Jack.
Man, I see it. I see it. Don't you worry about me seeing it.
See, here's what happened to you. You thought you knew the truth, but it wasn't there. And it never will be until you learn where to look.
I was messing with you, Peanut.
Man, I can catch it. I was just screwing around, man. Let me get one more shot.
One more shot?
Yeah.
My name is Peter Paul. I come from Montreal. I came to play them all. Make sure you see it. This is a king. This is your life. One mistake, and it can be taken away.
My father died of AIDS when I was 3 years old. My mother could no longer afford to pay my school fees. It was very hard to not be in school. I was in the slums alone.
Okay. That's another chess piece. We might play it later. From a Disney movie about, based on a true story of a young girl that learned how to play chess and that got her out of, she went on chess tournaments in different parts of the world. And the clip before that was from the movie Life of a King. And that movie, if it's not still on Netflix, is definitely on Amazon. I bought the digital copy from Amazon. And it's based on a true story of a guy that was in prison, and he got out and taught kids how to play chess. And he has, matter of fact, he has a place in, I think it's in Southeast Washington, D.C., the Big House. Chess House, something to that. Up to him twice over the years. I need to keep on trying. Matter of fact, next time I go to D.C., I'm going to just go over to the Big House and see if I can get him on the podcast that way because the phone's not working. But in any event, now we were talking about stress, chess strategies, the art and science of financial offense and defense, and you got to anticipate. And I use the black townships now. Since we're looking at Oklahoma, and somebody sent me something before I go to the phone lines here. Okay, the most dangerous cities in Oklahoma for 2022. And I'll name them. Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've been to Tulsa several times. Otterbell, Oklahoma. But you know what? When every place I stayed in Tulsa, and I go back to Tulsa as far as back as 1976. Definitely 77. Because I've been to the University of Tulsa. I was a basketball player in college. So University of Tulsa, everything was cool there. We stayed at the Sheraton. Every time I've been to Oklahoma, and I've been in and out of Oklahoma since the 70s, I've never felt no danger in that state at all. I mean, I've been to University of Tulsa, or Roberts University, which is probably the best laid-out university that I've personally set foot on so far, Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma, real nice. That's a good place to live. Then you've got Taft, Tallahassee, Summit, three black townships. They have more than that, but those are three I've been in. And then let me go down the list. All right, so they say this is, whoever put this together, the most dangerous cities for Oklahoma in 2022. So in my experiences in Tulsa, both day and night, I've never sensed any type of, any hint of crime. Not to say that there wasn't. Okay. Idabel, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Ardarco, Oklahoma. Now, they rank Tulsa as number one. So this goes down to 1 to 10. Anadarko, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Ardmore, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Ponca, Oklahoma, coming in at number 5, haven't been there. Hugo, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Dell City, Oklahoma, haven't been there. Now, Muskogee, Oklahoma, I've been there plenty of times. Matter of fact, in recent years, within the last 8 years or so, Tulsa, Oklahoma, you fly into there. I might stay there maybe a night sometimes, or maybe a night. I typically don't do two nights, but one night, and then go to my next destination in the state. But I've been to Muskogee, and I've slept in Muskogee plenty of times, walked by myself at night in Muskogee, and I've felt completely safe. So anyway, but they have them ranked at number 10 as it's the ninth most, according to this, whoever put this list together, the ninth most dangerous city in Oklahoma for 2022. They have Muskogee on there. But like I said, I've been through Muskogee by car and on foot, probably on foot more than anything else, and I have felt completely safe. And coming in at number 10, Oklahoma City. Now, I've been there a handful of times, mostly in the 70s. And I think that's the first place where I saw a Native American was in Oklahoma City. And I felt completely safe in that city, too. So, but this is 2022. I have not set foot in the state of Oklahoma in 2022. But of all the times I've been there, which includes Oklahoma City, Muskogee, and Tulsa, and others that are not listed on here, I've felt completely safe. And the towns that I've gone into in recent years, and Tulsa's one of them, and Muskogee's the other one, my destination was always, like, really towns that had, like, 400 people or less. Actually, to be honest about it, let's see. Tampa's probably the largest, 350, and they count the prison population in that, I think. And then Summit, Oklahoma, which they might have 100 people or so. It all depends on where you go. But like I say, it relating this back to Black Wall Street test is as one of your defenses. Okay, you have to look at where on the map are you going to move and set up your home, your household. Where on the map, the landscape, If you got a business and it's a stationary brick-and-mortar business, you know, where are you going to set up shop? And then you have to take, you know, you have to, you know, anticipate some things. And like in some places, you might have to put security cameras. And that you're good to go with that. In other places, you might need cameras plus metal shutters with locks that can't be, you know, penetrated easily. You know, within the business, during business hours, you might need a security guard. A security guard unarmed might do fine with some businesses. Other businesses might need an armed presence. Other businesses, you might need to hire people that live in that neighborhood. Like, for instance, if you're a Korean family or Vietnamese family and you have a liquor store, it might be wise to hire at least two people that are visible, that when customers come in from that neighborhood, they can see them. They say, all right, well, you know, let's not act up in this place. Let's not rob this place because they employ black people. So, and that's a deterrent. That is a, I would call that a chess move that saves some people. You know, in other places, I've seen Korean, you know, Asians and Latinos work together in various businesses, and that's their line of defense, as well as offense, because you got to play. You just can't play defense. You got to play offense too. So you have to anticipate this thing because, and even when it comes to generational wealth, you might live an entire life and nobody messes with you, your family. You know, nobody's, you know, burning a cross on your front yard. You know, nobody's beating up your kids, you know, on the way to and from school. Everything's great for 30, 40, maybe 50 years. But then, once again, chess involves thinking 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or more steps in advance of what could happen. So what's happening now? Now, you take gentrification. In order to turn the tables on gentrification or just outright beat it or avoid it altogether. Now I'm talking about for you and your children or grandchildren or great-grand, whatever you got, is you got to think 20, 30, 50, maybe even 100 years out. Like if you want your grandchildren to live in the same house, you know, you got to anticipate, or first thing you're going to have to raise them in a certain way. And one of the ways that, in other words, when you go to the neighborhood civic association meeting, all right, and they might be 2 years old, you need to start taking that 2-year-old to those civic association meetings and make everyone that you can with them. And when they get old enough to understand, explain to them why you were taking them to those meetings. In other words, you like living in grandpa's house or grandma's house or daddy's house or mom's house or whatever it might be. If you want to keep on living here and not deal with, you know, rent or a mortgage payment, you're going to have to get involved with the neighborhood. Going to those neighborhood meetings, learning how the system works, learn how the neighborhood works, is a chess move for what I call generational wealth. At least preserving it, keeping it going from generation to generation. All right. Same thing if you have a business in certain neighborhoods. You don't start taking these, dragging these kids to these meetings at 12, 14, and 15. No, too late. Take them when they're 2 and 3. Take them when, and they'll, through osmosis, they'll be picking up something. And you just keep, and then when they do understand, all right, you know, it's once a month. Out of 365 days out of the year, it's 12 meetings. And three of those meetings or holiday meetings. Because typically Halloween, they might have something for the kids. And in November, December, they might not meet at all, but if they do, it's a holiday. It's festive, you know, so kids will like it anyway with cake, ice cream, or whatever your neighborhood might, you know, put out there. Cookies and juice, what have you. I call those are strategic chess moves, and you're thinking, you know, like, say, showing up at 20, you're 19 years too late to show up at those meetings. Because a whole lot of planning does happen in those 19 years. All right. 19 to 20 years. So with Black Wall Street, and there's a handful of people, I'm sure we can find some historians, and I've had one on here a long time ago. It's about time to invite somebody else from Black Wall Street and his Black Wall Street historian on here. But it looks like they didn't have much of a first thing, it doesn't seem like they had a political defense, particularly with the planning department, because when they tried to rebuild, there were certain things, according to zoning, that they couldn't do. So you have to look at that. That's one of the pieces on the chessboard, the real-life chessboard. All right, now, their houses were looted, and they needed a defense for that. Obviously, they didn't have one. Now, they did have guns. Many of those households were armed, but it wasn't adequate. It wasn't adequate. It's just like in Detroit now. If you have a house in Detroit proper, you know, if you go away for a weekend and you go away Friday, and let's say some of your neighbors know, and you come back Sunday night, your house might be squatted in or broken into. And that happens in Detroit and other places, as wild as that might seem, but it happens on a regular. So you have to anticipate what your defense is, and you also have to, you know, come in with an offense. Here's an offense that you can play for your house or car. Let's say somebody tries to break into your car. All right. And you can have your car jerry-rigged. I don't know how to do it, but there are people that do know how to do it. Might get an idea or two on how to do it yourself on YouTube. Break into your car to steal it. And then when they get in the car, and they don't know how that car works, you know, you can have automatic doors where they can't unlock the doors from the inside. And then they can try to bust out the windows, but the windows are unbreakable. Car won't start. Or the car, although it won't start, it can make an alarm could go off where it'll alert other people around. And they'll alert you where you can call the police. You can jerry-rig a car like that now. You can also, so they can't escape, and you got them red-handed. That's a chess move. You can also jerry-rig your house that way, too. You know, if you want to go through that, where they can break in the house, but they can't break out. And then they're sorry that they ever even saw that house. I saw an episode of, the TV show Snowfall. The guys, there was one scene where they broke into a house. And they broke into a house, and there was a lion in the house. Oh, excuse me, a tiger. They were sorry they broke into that house. But these are all chess moves. Like I said, you had to anticipate. And then, you know, in something like that, when you got a lion, I mean, now that's extreme, when you got a tiger roaming around. But, or you can have a dog. You can have a Doberman Pinscher that, you know, a lot of dogs, when they hear something unusual, they bark. But you have some dogs, when they hear something unusual and you're not at the house, when master's not at the house, you can break in the house and the dog doesn't see. And this is, just say it's a Doberman Pinscher, particularly if it's two Doberman Pinschers. And they hear you break in, and they know exactly where you are in the house, but you don't hear, they don't bark, they don't snicker. And they let you get in the house, good in the house, and then you're attacked by one or two Doberman Pinschers. So that's a chess move. That's playing offense and defense at the same time. All right. And you also had to think about, like I say, if you're playing offense, you got to think about defense. There was a case many years ago, some of you heard about it. Getz was this guy's name. I forgot Getz's first name. But this guy, Getz in New York, white dude, he had previously been robbed and attacked and robbed in New York City. So Getz got himself armed, and he was on a subway one day, a bus, one of the two, in New York City, and he got attacked again. But this time now, he had a defense, and his defense allowed him to play offense. And he shot one of the people, and he got paralyzed. But the city of New York brought charges against Getz, and I think he got sued civilly, too. You know what? Getz. What is Getz's first name? And Getz is spelled G-O-E-T-Z. Bernard Getz. He's 74 years old right now. And let me see if I can read something about the case. Me personally, I defend what Getz did. All right, here it is. 1984 New York City subway shooting. On December the 22nd, 1984, Bernard Getz shot four young men on a New York City subway train in Manhattan after they allegedly tried to rob him. And once again, Getz had been assaulted before. All right. And New York City, that's the landscape. He knew the landscape. He knew New York City. He knew on that subway or the public transportation, you are at risk. He knew the landscape. So he got a gun. And I don't blame him. Typically, I'm not on the gun bandwagon, but in this case, I can't blame him for doing it. He had a Smith & Wesson Model 38. Nobody was killed. Four injured. They were Barry Allen, Troy Canty, Daryl Canby, and James Rossimer. Motive, they have self-defense. Now, let's see. Verdict, he was found guilty of third-degree criminal possession of a weapon. See, this is why I don't like government. I think government shouldn't even brought charges against him. And he was found not guilty on remaining charges. All right, he was charged with four counts of attempted murder. He beat that. He was charged with four counts of assault. He was charged with reckless endangerment. He was charged with third-degree criminal possession of a weapon. Fourth-degree criminal possession of a weapon, three counts. Getz was ordered to pay $43 million to KB. I think that's the guy that he shot and paralyzed in a civil trial for reckless and the deliberate infliction of emotional distress. Now, see, this is, I'm going to use it, you know, fucked up. What other term can you, other than fucked up? Because it was a case of either Getz was going to either be killed or maimed for life or the other guy. This guy, KB, Oh, what's his full name? Daryl Cabey. What's that? Beasley, you brought it up here before. Play stupid game, win stupid prizes. He got sentenced to 1 year in jail on top of the $43 million civil trial. And he was paroled. He was paroled after 8 months. So they figure, well, we can't let him off scot-free. And it is New York City and whatnot. You know, we don't want everybody to be a cowboy. I'm just looking at the way maybe the government looked at it. But he only did 8 months on the 12-year sentence. Excuse me. Oh, yeah. He only did 8 months. He got a year in jail, and he made parole, and he got out after 8 months. All right. Get surrendered to police 9 days later and was charged with attempted murder, assault, reckless endangerment, several firearm offenses. Initially, Getz was viewed by most as a victim and by some as a vigilante, and received widespread recognition and support. A grand jury, and I wonder who was on that grand jury, refused to indict Getz on more serious charges of voting indictments only on one criminal gun possession. However, public opinion about Getz wavered to statements of alleged damaging details of the incident that later was released by the prosecution. Getz was then re-indicted by a second grand jury on a more serious charges. All right, there's a lot of politics involved with this because it was a high-profile case. But Getz, once again, knew the chess landscape of New York City. So Getz is living. He's 74 years old right now. And he's, you know, out of the four. Now, he was outnumbered 4-1. He was outnumbered 4-1. See, that's what a lot of cowards do. They can't put up the Dukes 1-on-1 and talking shit. This was four of them. And more than likely, Getz had been ganged up on and robbed before. This was not Getz's first rodeo. So I do not blame. You know what? When you're living in a jungle like that, where you is either your life or their life, because most murder cases are not solved. Most murder cases go unsolved, particularly in a place like New York City. So Getz said, "Never. I'm not going to get caught out here naked again." And he got himself weaponized. And like I said, four of them. What are you going to do? In my opinion, he shouldn't even have been arrested, let alone tried. You know, and although he won a $43 million, and I don't know if Getz appeals that, but I doubt, you know, Getz wasn't a millionaire, so, you know, he'd try to collect blood out of a turnip. In a place like New York. Now, if you can't hang in New York, go to a place where there's dramatically less crime. Okay. And even in a rural area, there's crime out there too. But, you know, and maybe, like I said, I spent quite a bit of time in Muskogee, Oklahoma, so I felt perfectly safe. But, you know, now I'm comparing it to places where I've been. I've been in New York City, Chicago, D.C. and all that. And that, but now there were two times where I thought, these dudes are trying to size me up to rob me. That's the kind of vibe I got. But, you know, they didn't try anything. And, you know, that quickly passed. But, because to take shortcuts, I've gone through, you know, I don't have no problem going through a dark alley. But that's me. But I've been fortunate so far. I'll say that, very fortunate. But anyway, that's why I love the game of chess, because you have to know the landscape. And the Bernard Goetz case, although it was a highly publicized case, there are cases like that all the time. Now, I was the day before yesterday, somebody sent me a text. Here we go. Facebook. Let me read some of this, and I'm opening up the phone lines, because we're talking about chess strategies, the art and science of financial. Oh, you know what? The art and science of defense, offense and defense, because it just might not be financial. We'll get into that a different day when we're talking about, you know, how to protect your house from getting housejacked and tax foreclosures and all that. That's a whole. We'll get into that later. We're just talking about basic, fundamental. What can you do offensively and defensively to protect what's yours, including your life? So, a couple of days ago, a friend of mine on Facebook sent me some instant messages, and I'll read you the headlines. And I like to apply chess to these three incidences. Real life story. Here's the first headline. New York City bodega worker arrested. So let's see why he was arrested. He or she was arrested. All right, this is out of the New York Post. New York City bodega worker arrested for allegedly stabbing man to death over a bag of chips. Over a bag of chips. I forgot. You know, when I do buy a bag of chips, I forgot how much they cost now. But let me read this real quick. A Manhattan bodega worker. And for people who don't know what a bodega is, it's basically a convenience store. That's what it is, sorry. A Manhattan bodega worker, in Detroit, they call a bodega or a convenience store in the city of Detroit party stores. That's what's so tailored, but it's a convenience store, right? A Manhattan bodega worker was arrested for allegedly stabbing a man to death during a fight over a bag of chips. Police said this past Saturday, Jose Alba, 51, is accused of plunging a knife into the chest of a 35-year-old Austin Simon inside the Hamilton Heights grocery on a Broadway. You don't need to add to it, sorry. A violence that, anyway, long story short, people, a bag of chips. But what a bag of chips cost, what, 50 cents? A dollar, 70 cents, you know, depends on the size of the bag. You know, it's a big bag, you know, $2, $3, $4, I don't know. Next story. And as I read these, you know, let's think about the game of chess. What do we need to anticipate so we won't lose our lives or get in trouble over a bag of chips? These are real stories. I'm not making this up. Here's the next story. McDonald's worker shot over cold fries has died. All right. The Brooklyn McDonald's worker who was shot in the neck in a spat over cold fries has died, cops announced on Friday. Matthew Webb, 23, succumbed to his injuries after he was shot Monday outside of Bedford Stuyvesant fast food restaurant where he worked. The attack has been deemed as a homicide, the force said early Friday morning, stressing the investigation still remains ongoing. Michael Morgan, 20, has already been charged with attempted murder and criminal possession of a loaded firearm for blasting Webb in anger at his mom getting some cold French fries. Okay, this joker is 20 years old. They're at McDonald's or wherever. The fries are not hot enough for his mother. So he goes back up to the counter. One thing leads to a next. This story's out of New York City. You know what? This is why I like to use the game of chess. Know the landscape. I'm not going to no place where I feel I need to have a gun. I'm just not going. If I got to go to the other side of town, if I wanted French fries that bad, or if I got to go to the grocery store and make my own, get the potatoes or whatever, I'm not knowingly going to any place where I have to have a gun. Just me. That's just me, just in case. Now, we've all got different life experiences. I had an uncle, and of course, uncle old enough to be my father. You know, he grew up in a different era where I remember him telling me one day, you know, today I just felt like I had to have my gun with me. But see, I didn't grow up in his era. Didn't grow up in this era. So, however, there are people now that are 12, 14, 15 years old that, judging from these headlines I'm reading, if you're in Brooklyn, New York, the Bed-Stuy neighborhood, depending on where you go in, you might have to have a weapon. I know my mother and several other females I've known over the years, whether they live in a big town or small town, they carry weapons with them. It could be a long blade, a nail file, a mace, one of those things that electric shock somebody. I heard those are legal, but they came around. So I've met women that they carry weapons with them because, you know, based on previous experiences or somebody close to them had a negative experience. So they say, you know what, it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And I get and understand that. I call those strategic chess moves. All right, the last one I'm going to read is, and you know, what kind of offense and defense do you have? Ex-NFL star Aqib Talib, brother turns himself in after slaying of a youth football coach. Here's a case where, well, let me read it. Lancaster, Texas. The brother of retired NFL cornerback Aqib Talib turned himself into authorities Monday after police identified him as a suspect in the fatal shooting of a coach at a youth football game in Texas. A murder warrant was issued for Yaqub Salih Talib, 39, in the fatal shooting Saturday night of Michael Hickman, 43. These are young men. Police in Dallas area city of Lancaster. Let's see, right. The landscape today for sporting activities, you have, look on YouTube. There have been referees who have been beat up because they made a call that the crowd did not agree with. And if you get beat up, sometimes getting a beat down can go wrong and somebody can get killed. So, you know, look on YouTube. There's no shortages of videos just getting beat up in the classroom. Go on YouTube right now. Now, I used to be one of those people, teachers in the classroom. I never got beat up. Now, I could have got jumped one day after school. You know, that could have happened. But it didn't happen. But I would have been, let's see, would have been about three or four people, students. We're talking about at a middle school. Fortunately, that particular day, two of the three of the guys that this guy called were preoccupied with girls or whatever. So I just kept on walking. Nobody followed me. I got in my car and went home. But anyway, you got to think offensively and defensively. Now, if you can get to a place or a situation where you don't have to do this, then great. But even if you're in a remote area in the wilderness of Alaska, you've got nature. You know, what do you do if you turn your head and there's I don't know if they have cougars or mountain lions in Alaska, but they got bears and they have other wildlife. That if you're not a proficient woodsman or with a proficient woodsman, you're done. There's a lot of people that go to Alaska and they go out into the wilderness and they're never to be heard from again. So that's, know the landscape. Know the landscape. All right, so any comments on that? Like, say, it's from the black townships, I'm looking at them, is what did they do? The chess move that they made was, number one, don't buy any land to set up a community within hostile territory. They didn't do that. That's I would say, chess move-wise, that's the big takeaway. And that strategy's worked for over 100 years. Here in Florida, you got Eatonville, Florida, 6 miles outside of Orlando. Over 100 years, no racial problems. Why? They set up shop, because we hear about Rosewood all the time. But a lot of people, you probably got some black people that live in Florida that have never, born in Florida, raised in Florida, that probably have never heard of Eatonville. But they've heard of Rosewood. So, defense. And sometimes your best offense is your defense. I mean, they Joseph Clark and the founders of Eatonville, I'm sure they how old is Eatonville? Eatonville, when did they incorporate? They were incorporated on August 15th, 1887. This is about a few days ago. Okay, Eatonville's 135 years old. 135 years, and not 1 second of racial problems. Not one. Interesting, Hollywood hasn't made a movie about Eatonville But they made one about Rosewood, and Rosewood wasn't even a black township. Rosewood had about 10 or 15 black households in it. And the wealthiest people in Rosewood at the time were the people that owned the sawmill. But when they torched Rosewood, they torched everybody's house, torched more white folks' houses than black people's houses. But for some reason, that story hasn't translated that way. However, Eatonville, 135 years old, as of two, three days ago, not a second of racial violence, and they're just 6 miles outside of Orlando. So where they placed Eatonville, okay, I'm sure that was they were thinking about where can we be safe now, and where can our children and grandchildren, because you know back then they were having kids younger anyway, where will they feel in it for 135 years? They've been good. And there are other towns like that most people have never heard of. All right, let's go to the phone lines here before I run my mouth all day. 410 area code, your mic is open.
Hotel, Brother L.A., and all of the people that's listening to your show. Look, the landscape in America is, if you're black, there's no place safe. Not in your own neighborhood, not in other racial ethnic groups' neighborhoods, because propaganda has been put out that a black man's life is worthless and a black woman's life is worthless. So,
Let me ask you this question now. How can you explain Eatonville or Tampa, Oklahoma, or Highland Park, Maryland, or Fairmont Heights, Maryland?
There's different types of
those are all
of
black townships with no problems. I mean, no
exactly.
Violent problems.
Well, that's my point. There's all types of danger that you can be put in. And the thing is, there's no recorded history of violence against those people in that town, but, you know, I had to bring it to your attention.
Well, you're right about that. Nothing recorded.
Exactly. But now the thing is, they are in a safe haven. But the thing is, you can be minding your business and you black. And the thing is, somebody can always, they can always threaten. Because I brought this up to, I don't know if I brought it up on the air or not, but when the gentleman was talking about Mound Bayou, I asked him a question, a TRM Howard, I believe.
Yep.
And he said the white folks went in there and ran him out of town. Well, you didn't hear of any violence being forced against Mound Bayou, but the thing is, those white folks ran this gentleman out of town, and he was in upstate. Upstanding citizen in that town. He was a doctor and he brought a lot of industry to that town.
About 1,000 acres of land.
That's right. He had to leave all of that. But the thing is, just because you haven't heard it don't mean that you can't prepare for it. That's the key. You have to be able to defend whatever you have. Because as black people, you never know when bigotry and prejudice will rear its ugly head. So you got to be prepared for it. Just because you haven't heard it don't mean that somebody in these towns hadn't been badgered or either terrorized or what have you. But you're safer when you're amongst your own and you can defend yourself better. I'll say that. But the thing is, Booker T. Washington wrote about black towns. He said black folks wanted to get away from the bigotry and the hatred, and they wanted to be able to control their own space. And if I find that quote, I'll send it to you. But he was in favor of black folks going out and building their own towns and their own commercial centers. So
now let me ask you this now. Like you take a, I'm just going to throw out there Detroit. Detroit or Chicago, you take your pick. What about protecting that? Some people have to protect themselves against their own kind.
That's what I was saying. Black people ain't safe nowhere they go. Because, look, I'm going to say this. Nobody has really looked under the sheets of why Chicago is the way it is. There's a reason why there's a lot of violence in Chicago. And in Detroit, there's a lot of reasons why there's violence in Chicago. I mean, in Detroit, but especially Chicago. And the thing is, nobody has really analyzed that situation. But you're right. Now, the thing is, as far as L.A. is concerned, with the Bloods and the Crips and everything else, I sent you a link about the Bloods and the Crips and all of that stuff. They're terrorizing the neighborhood. That wasn't the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, you could say they're Ku Klux Klan perpetrators, I guess that's the right word, in black.
Yeah. You're right. They're doing more damage than the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you look at it and you find out why they're the way they are and who is their biggest influence, you'll find out that, hey, look, it's white folks in the government that's behind all of this. So that's another thing we got to look out for. A lot of things happening in our neighborhoods that, hey, we don't look into it, but it's to make sure that there's a lot of strife and there's a lot of confusion in our neighborhoods. But you have to be prepared, and you have to make sure that you know the landscape, like you said before, and you got to look and delve into investigate why things are happening in your neighborhood. In fact, I'm going to say this, Brother L.A., and I know I'm going to get some pushback on it. Black folks don't do enough intelligence work where they live. We should be.
You're right. I agree.
We should be able to be on the alert and look out for everything and gather information around where we live, because that'll stop a lot of the violence where we live at. But we're just happy-go-lucky. We go to church and shout and sing, and, you know, we listen to Reverend Hoop and Holler. And the thing is, we go and we have our barbecues and we have our bars and we drink beer and everything, but we need to have an intelligence arm everywhere we are to really look out and gather information on things that's happening around us. Because, like
now,
you said before.
Yeah, I agree with you, but now what about the closest thing I can think of for intelligence in a neighborhood would be like your neighborhood association, the civic association, that's what they call them. Or there might be, remember that TV show Bewitched, and they had one of the neighbors, Gladys Kravitz, who was basically a busybody, but she knew everything going on in the neighborhood. But you got to go beyond that, though, because your intelligence also includes, you know, what the planning department, you know, who's applied for building permits, of that nature.
Yeah, just a neighborhood watch. That's a form of intelligence.
Yeah.
Because where I live at, if anybody comes in my yard or anywhere in the area, I'm getting a phone call from my home. And if I'm not home and I can't get there, then my neighbors will call the sheriff department. And vice versa, I do the same thing for them too. If I see suspicious suspicious activity around where they live, I'm making a phone call.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just the way it is. But now, when I say intelligence, we need to have people dedicated to going to county commissioner meetings. What do you call these meetings in these cities? Alderman meetings.
Yeah.
We need to be checking out everything that we can to see why things are happening the way they are. And I'm going to give you an example. See, Ray Ray, on the street corner, selling drugs. He's getting those drugs from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask him where Colombia is or where a place is in Mexico, and you put a map in front of him, he couldn't tell you where the hell it's at. He probably couldn't even spell Colombia. He probably couldn't spell Costa Rica. But the thing is, the drugs is coming in our neighborhood. We supposed to know how Ray Ray is getting those drugs. And we supposed to follow it all the way up to the food chain to find out how this stuff is getting here. No
right.
black community has ever done that. No black community has ever done that. Because, see, when you get to the head, you can stop Ray Ray. Because Ray Ray ain't got sense enough to fly a plane down into South America and pick up some crack. He can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he doesn't have the means. Ray Ray ain't got enough money to go and buy a gun. But he's getting a gun. We need to know how he's getting it and who's giving it to him. And when we find out who it is, we need to deal with it. The person or the organizations that's giving these young boys this crack and these guns. That's what I mean by intelligence.
Okay.
Because, see, that's the root of the violence in our neighborhoods. We need to find out how this happened. And we need to be dedicated towards it and have a group of people just at making it their business to check Ray Ray out and to keep a watch on him or her or Jeannie Mae to find out how this is being done. See,
mm-hmm.
we allow things to fester in our neighborhood because we just go along to get along. But that's what I mean by intelligence.
It is needed. It is definitely needed.
And look, we need offense. When you find out something like that, we need to go on offense. Defense is good, but defense is only good after something has been done. But see, well, you're a young brother, L.A., but the old folks had a saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
If you take
preventive measures, it's cheaper than going in and trying to cure something. If you catch it in advance, it's cheaper to catch it in advance than to wait until it gets so far out of hand until you can't handle it.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is Monday morning quarterback, and 100 years later. In your opinion, what preventive measures Black Wall Street, the Greenwood neighborhood, taken back? You know, going back to prior to 1921, it happened in 1921, so they were there before that. So what do you think they could have done to prevent that or at least not go to the extent that it went?
Well, that's water under the bridge. That's gone. I can deal with what's happening today in a limited way.
Mm-hmm.
I just gave you an example about intelligence. Here's the thing. In order for anything to happen, there have to be propaganda to get a mindset in a position to want to do something violently to a person or people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's your first link right there. Who in the world is putting out propaganda against a neighborhood? Or who is it that's behind somebody coming in and putting down and, you know, getting the city to come up with a program, an eminent domain program? Who is the one that's coming in and saying, hey, part of D.C., we want that. And the best way to get it is to gentrify it. Somebody had to be in a back room planning that.
Right.
It just didn't happen.
There was no mole, because a mole gets you intelligence also.
That's right. So the first thing you do is, hey, look, when the city council brings up their proposal, you find out who the city council person is that's pushing this thing. And you find out whose pocket he's in or she's in.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is you follow it all the way up, and pretty soon you're going to find out the root to that problem.
Right.
Like I just told you about Ray Ray. Ray Ray, it can't even get out of his own neighborhood, haven't been across the other part of town. But yet and still, he's getting a lot of drugs in here and flooding our neighborhood with drugs. We need to find out who's giving Ray Ray his drugs and who's giving Ray Ray his guns. And once you follow it up, you're supposed to deal with that situation offensively, not defensively. Offensively, but you can do it defensively because, see, when you stop Ray Ray, there's probably about 10 other Ray Rays out there doing the same thing he's doing in your neighborhood. But see, you go to the source.
Right.
You go to the source, and you can stop all 20 of them at one time, and you ain't got to spill a lot of blood doing that. But that's what I mean by that. Now, let me give you another one. Somebody coming in there shooting up your neighborhood or setting fires to your churches. What we did here is we set up a patrol, and we had people guarding our property. And the thing is, we didn't have any church burnings here. And they were burning a lot of churches. The first thing we did was we set up a guard schedule, and we pulled guard duty around our churches. And if we saw anything suspicious, we had some cars on each end of the community to follow those cars to find out where they were going. That's how you go in and you stop a lot of stuff. Now, this thing about Wall Street.
You know what, had that strategy, you know what, when that Dylann Roof thing and whatever, South Carolina, Georgia, wherever he was, because he wasn't stopped and frisked at the door.
No, he wasn't, but black folks don't.
They just let him on in there.
But black folks don't deal in security. You can come in our neighborhood and do anything you want to do. But you ride in a white neighborhood, somebody's going to want to know what your business is.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's going to call the police. I know you've heard talk of black folks riding through their neighborhood. Look at Aubrey. What's his name? Aubrey.
Oh, yeah, them boys, Ahmed Aubrey. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Them boys saw him running through the neighborhood. They confronted him. Now, they went overboard.
Right.
But all they had to do was just observe him. See, you know, what the heck is going on here? They didn't have to shoot him. But
right.
When you see people around in your neighborhood that don't live there, you're supposed to know what the heck is going on here. And a lot of black folks say, well, the thing is, you're nosy and you're always trying to get in other folks' business. No, that's security. That's making sure that your neighborhood.
Because I know in my neighborhood in D.C. now, my neighborhood is now gentrified, but I remember back in the 70s, even 80s, particularly the 80s, I remember I saw a white person, matter of fact, the shoe had dropped in, because I saw a white dude walk through my neighborhood, and he looked completely out of place. Middle-class black neighborhood, but he just, you know. And then there was another one that got off the subway stop for that neighborhood. So, anyway, but yeah, I should have known something was coming then.
Yeah, but now look, I tell you what. Now, let me give you this one, show you how backwards we are. I can walk through a certain neighborhood in Chicago, in L.A., well, not so much New York anymore. And somebody's going to attack me or either come and confront me, black. But now a white boy or a white girl can walk through there and go anywhere they want to and nobody will mess with them. See, that's how backwards we are. But what you and I are talking about are preventive measures.
Right.
To make sure that, hey, look, what is your business here? You don't have to confront them. You just keep an eye on them. And then if they look like they're doing something suspicious, that's when you act. But the thing is, black folks can't get
it. Yeah. I was in Western Pennsylvania once, and I was looking for a guy's house. He had an underground house. It was a solar-built house. It catches sunlight and all that other stuff. But, so I couldn't find his house. I had driven past the house. I didn't know I had driven past his house 5 or 6 times. So I went to the middle of that little village and asked the lady, and she asked, who are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for her. I gave the guy's name. And then she told me exactly how to get there. And I followed the way she told me. But that's to go along with what you're saying. Everybody in that little town knows everybody.
Yeah.
And that is a form of intelligence.
But
probably got a call. He knew I was coming anyway, because I was coming from out of town. But he probably got a call before I got there from the lady that told me, exactly where he was. I'm just saying.
Yeah, probably so, because that's the way it's done here. My parents used to, I think I told you, my parents used to run a country store. So quite naturally, when anybody was looking for anybody, they stopped at the store.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I don't know where you are, but in black towns, if there's a store around, there's always a bunch of black folks hanging around that store, because they don't want to be home and they meet a lot of people. Back in the day, they used to do that.
Right.
So the person would come in and say, well, look, I'm looking for so-and-so. Nobody ever knew that person. They'd know who that person is. But nobody knew that person and they ever heard of it. But now when that person left, the person that person was looking for would get a phone call and say, well, look, such and such came here looking for you. And the thing is, we just thought you would want to know. But now as far as them giving out information, well, no, we never heard anybody like that here. I must be in the next town somewhere. But that's security. That's security. Because you never know what a person's looking for a person for. But I'm just giving you those tips. But now you take Tulsa, like Wall Street, yeah, I could tell you what they could have done, but I won't tell you on the air. And I can tell you what we need to do here, but I ain't going to tell you on the air, because those things need to be discussed in a back room somewhere amongst each other.
Well, fair enough. Let me go to the next caller here. I got some stats. Now, one of these stats, Pianki, I got to disagree with. On Eatonville, Florida, I've been to Eatonville several times, and I'm wondering how they're duking these stats, because I've felt perfectly safe when I've been to Eatonville. I've been to Eatonville both day and night. Anyway.
Well, L.A., you got to believe in something. So you can find city data pretty accurate. When I compare it to cities I know of, it's pretty accurate for the year that
it
broke.
All right, one stat I'm looking at here, okay, well, I guess the metric I'm going for are the violent crimes, okay. One stat that I will agree with here, with Eatonville, is thefts. They got 42 of them. I believe that because in Taft, Oklahoma, the number one crime in Taft, Oklahoma is theft. What they do is, because Taft has an older population.
In, for the sake of time, because some people are just long-winded. Why don't you just type in Taft and see what it says? But let me just go on, because it's after 11:30, man.
All right, Taft. Yeah, well, with Taft, what they've done there is they have people that come from out of town to Taft.
Regardless where they come from, it's talking about the crime in the town. Just like in St. Louis, people talk about Kyle Rittenhouse.
Uh-huh.
And what he done, I tell you, he's a hero. But you had some blacks in St. Louis City on 20th and Washington Street was walking down the street. Some people say a half dozen, say a dozen, shooting up every damn thing. And some of them had to come from over in Illinois, coming across the East Bridge, because they closed. I don't know if it's the East Bridge or the Martin Luther King Bridge that they closed after certain times. I don't think it's the East Bridge to keep people from walking across it, coming out of East St. Louis. Them criminals. I think I sent you that story.
Yeah, I'm
so that makes things just perfectly bad. You know, you I forgot all that I sent you. I just sent you a picture of a site of a friend of mine, young man, Kevin Bryant, who's gentrifying north of Delmar in St. Louis off of Euclid Avenue.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yes. And guess what? North of Delmar is generally black. South of Delmar, you got the Central West End. Then over at Forest Park on Further, actually you got to go further than that because you got to get past the hospital complexes. Further than that to, say, Manchester on over, that's South St. Louis. So north of Delmar is black. And they moving blacks out of them homes in those neighborhoods because they can't maintain them. It just don't ran down to condemnation status. I mean, that's what you expect. Blacks run from those areas. But Kevin's doing a pretty good job to be so young. He's struggling a little bit with it, but they're making it.
I'm looking at that right now. Meet Kevin
Bryant. I offer him a design for some homes that he asked me to do. So let's see what happened with it. And another thing, you talk about Oklahoma. I gave you a report, information on the crime in Oklahoma. Tulsa is the most crime-ridden area in Oklahoma. And then I sent you an NPR story about the Supreme Court ruling. Most of Oklahoma belongs to the Creek and the Muscovy Creek, including Tulsa. Now, that court decision was in 2020. So if you go back to 1919, when Tulsa became a state, it was more owned by Creek Indians. Blacks didn't own that land. They might have leased it because you don't own it. You can lease it, but you don't own it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's where they choose to do business. Perfectly fine.
Your comment on Tulsa. Now, when I made my comment about Tulsa, I said, now this is me personally, because I've been through Tulsa several times. I haven't noticed any problem. I know there's crime everywhere.
You got a lucky angel.
Depends on how you define it and what metric. I've never been bothered.
You got a lucky angel over you, L.A.
I must.
You blessed.
But then at the same time,
Let me tell you something. I don't allow my grandson and daughter to be in North St. Louis City. She got an aunt. Mm-hmm. My wife's sister lives in North St. Louis. My grandson went to a high school off of Grand and Vandeventer, Cardinal Ritter, and I told him, don't go across Vandeventer North going home. Go up to Grand and go across Grand. So you can't drive through those neighborhoods. I don't care what the heck color you are. You can't. You crazy. You remember when you had that one incident with the black males killing that security guard at the pawn shop, at Lee's Pawn Shop, there on Martin Luther King off of, that's right not too far from where I just described as far as I don't want him to go across there. So you just got, and that used to, that's over by Homer G. Phillips, Sumner High School, and other landmarks. You just can't drive in those areas. Father Lou Times, you ever heard of him? He's a radio celebrity.
No, I haven't.
Father Lou Times was a famous radio celebrity in St. Louis. His daughter, Denise, was driving down the street off of Taylor Avenue going east, and a bullet coming through her window hit her in the neck and killed her. Mm. It's just that treachery and savagery in those areas. I mean, that's just the way it is. when you have those type of people in communities. And it ain't all blacks, because guess what? The Ville area, Walnut Park, Penrose Park, blacks of decency and functionality fled those areas. They still do today. Now, what the problem is, I don't know. I can't tell you. It's just terrible.
Now, what's his name again? Father Lou, L-O-U, right?
Father Lou Times.
Okay, Father Lou.
Now, since you know the thing on black businesses, and most black businesses, according to these stats, and which is okay, it's a black business, is in the service industry, in the health industry. They still lacking in manufacturing production, although that there is beginning to change. But I'm talking about some serious manufacturing, but you have to work your way up to that, I guess. It's still not a worldwide technology company, but if you look at the charts, it's what the chart says, that they're more concentrated in service industry. And I think that's because that's where you find a lot of them working. And also, if you look at the education that they go and pursue, it has a lot to do with service industry.
Yeah.
You know, if your society don't have engineers and scientists, you subject yourself to a whole lot of stuff that tears down your infrastructure. That's in any society, not just black. And then it all works its way back to the education. If your kids are not being educated, the kids are not being educated in America in those type of schools. And you know, I tell you something else too. Whether the school is in the inner city or where it moves out into the suburbs, you still have the same dismal educational results. Ain't no white folks behind that. I dare somebody to show me where it is. That's black-controlled educational system. I tell you what, I was talking to a school board member whose son sat on the city council at first. I'm not going to tell you his name. And we talked about Normandy School District. Mm-hmm. Would you believe that this black school district had a grading system that was the following? You had your A's, your B's, your C's, and your D's. Then get this. You had F plus, F, and F minus. What kind of crazy mess is that?
I never heard of F minus.
F plus, F, and F minus.
Yeah,
that's Negro
never heard
mentality
of that.
Right there. So you couldn't talk about it if it didn't exist, right?
Mm.
But other than that, there's a lot of good things that you can find that's going on in black communities. You just don't have enough of it. And really, overall, there really isn't that great of an impact. When you look at the businesses, Hispanics do about 3 to 4 times more business income that black businesses does. And then you got the Native Americans even encroaching. I think Native Americans are even encroaching on them real fast. So I don't know what to say.
You are correct. And I'm going to just take Washington, D.C. as a backdrop, which is no longer what they call Chocolate City. But I think what happened with D.C., because D.C., well, is a government-type town or metro area. I think the blacks that came there went overboard on let's get a government job, and you know they got their nice houses.
Well, they did what they had to do.
Yeah,
they did what they had to do.
Right there.
Yeah, let me tell you something else. This stuff about we need to have our own control, own stores and own shops and this, that, and the other. Let me say something to you. That ain't satisfying or not benefit blacks as a whole. That only benefit a few people. How many damn grocery stores you going to have in a community with, say, 50,000 people or even 10,000 people? You're not going to have them on every corner of the block. Then it's only a few that benefit from that, and they expect blacks to come shop from them, but they're not going to do it. They're going to go wherever the heck they want to. Case in point, look at your politics. Look at your Nancy Pelosi. Or look at your this recent thing with this woman, Cheney, Liz Cheney. In 2017, mm-hmm. she came into office worth about $1 to $4 million. She lost it the other day, and her worth is over $40 million. All right? Look at Maxine Waters. As long as she's been in politics, she's only worth about $4 million. Look at, what's his name, Clyburn. He's reported worth $100,000 to a million. And all the rest of them, $100,000 to the million. They just can't do it. Think. They can't do it. No better than what we're seeing. Nancy Pelosi's son. She went to Taiwan here a week or so ago. Then she goes to Singapore where he has business dealings. I mean, that's just the way it is. She's back now, I think.
Okay. It is. That she was in the news, what, last week
that
over
bring
there?
In them big bucks, they just can't, they don't, you don't find them there. Now, if they ever got there, you know, I started erecting structural steel when I was 19 years old.
Uh-huh.
So when I got around to the time where I wanted to form my own company, erecting it, and I forget how old I was, but I had to put in dozens, decades of years in order to gain experience. You can't go to Harvard or Yale and learn how to do that. And here's another thing. Ain't no a firm or no conglomerate going to turn you loose with putting up a damn office building. So you got to know what the hell you're doing. I mean, that's just common sense. But the opportunities exist in many different areas, more so today than any time before.
Well, I agree with that. It's just a matter of, you know, what people need to, you know, find. Like, for what you did, it's, like I said, they're not teaching that at Harvard or Yale. So people
that's
have to know,
right.
Where,
I had
where
a friend
can
of mine
I go
up
get...
in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend of mine up in Kansas City was a structural engineer, and his company was called Du Bois. I can't think of his last name of the company, but he sold his company to an employee that worked for him. He worked on there for a few months in order to make sure he was, you know, on the up and up with what he was doing. But that's a very lucrative business. I was talking to a Nigerian friend of mine who's a mechanical engineer, and he's out on the East Coast, I think in Philadelphia, as the lead mechanical engineer for the firm that he works for. And Nigerians are smart. Very, very highly brilliant, innovative.
Well, they're big. In Africa, they're big, very big on education.
Well, they're big on education, but they're big on business here in the United States. And especially the high-paid professions like the medical fields. If it wasn't for Nigerian black, quote-unquote, doctors, you wouldn't have hardly no black.
Well, I did notice that several years ago I was at the Providence Hospital in D.C., Northeast D.C., and I did notice, matter of fact, I can't, most doctors I saw either African or from India, A or B. I can't recall
your
any white
Haitians,
doctors here that day.
Your Haitians are big in areas like medical, like operational and patient support, like anesthesiology. A lot of Haitians, Haitians are anesthesiologists.
That's
I know
a
one
profession.
Brother in California who's a cardiac perfusionist, and he's been doing it for, you know, some time. So in the medical field, we don't have nowhere near enough because of the education. You got too many people doing basketball and football only and not hitting on the academic.
Well, yeah, it's overload sports.
Yeah.
It's
even
overloaded.
To the point where you got kids in high school that's basketball players that are being paid $100,000 through different arrangements based on the name, image, and likeness.
That's true,
I think,
with Instagram followers.
What, if that's what they want, if that's what they want to do, let them do it. But I'm just going to leave with this. That whole idea about what we're saying that we need to have our that only benefits a few people. That don't benefit people as a whole. Look at, you talk about Claude Anderson. Claude Anderson owned Waterland Fisheries. Look it up on the internet. When he got ready to get rid of that, guess who got it? Asians.
Don't tell me Asians.
They did. Asians got it. He didn't get it. Not blacks. Now, I don't know if he pursued blacks or what. You look at the YouTube when they are touring the place.
You know, I saw Negroes a couple of those videos of Claude Anderson when he was trying to get that thing off the ground.
Mm-hmm. You look at the people that came to visit, that they, what did they got in their hand? They got in hand a plate of fish. They come there to eat. They come there to do no serious talking. It's talk. Anyway, man, it's 11:50. I'm going to let you get off here.
You got the last word of the day. Everybody have a good rest of the day.